Tell me a little bit more about your background, how you got into translation.
My passion has been languages my whole life, and I started being more and more interested, and then I thought I should start something on my own, and you know, it's e-commerce and languages, I should put them all together. This is how Wild Thing Translations was born. And then I decided, you know what, like, I can train my whole teams, and we're gonna have like an Amazon marketing translation experts. And that was a game changer, honestly. The moment we niched down, what opened a whole new universe for us.
Why shouldn't we use things like ChatGPT?
It doesn't understand context and it doesn't understand nuances.
How do you survive Amazon?
I think you need a lot of...
Welcome to Surviving Amazon, the podcast that exposes the brutal truth behind selling on Amazon, where only the strongest survive. We bring you insider stories and strategies from experts and sellers who have been through all the ups, the downs, and the moments. I'm Johnny Bradley, and today we're joined by Yana from YLT Translations, who has helped sellers battle their way through the chaos of selling on Amazon and cross-country selling through your listing translations. What many people don't know is that I worked for a project with Apple on translations, and I got an insider look on how a company even like that can struggle with making something that's culturally appropriate in like the localized voice of a native speaker. And Yana's worked with some of the largest companies in the world, so I'm really super excited to have her on today to talk about this. She's helped sellers live it, survive it, and she's here to share exactly how she does it. So Yana, how do you survive Amazon?
I think you need a lot of supplements, great nutrition, and I think you need help from AI tools. This is what I think you need. Lots of those you can get on Amazon, talking about supplements. So you need Amazon in order to survive Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Maybe a different answer from what a few people have given. They're like, you know, push through and persevere and don't give up. You're right. If you don't really look after yourself, like, maybe it's a bit of a joke, but it is so true that I take, I don't know, 20 different supplements a day. I actually feel a noticeable difference if I don't. Maybe it's a placebo, you know, it's all in my head. But yeah, you gotta look after yourself, because it is a battlefield and it is really hard to get through it. Tell me a little bit more about your background, how you got into translation and that whole story.
I'm actually a translator myself. I got bachelor's and master's in 3 languages and literature. So my passion has been languages my whole life. And then fast forward to end of my university, I got offered a job. And I was always like really interested in, you know, like electronics, like internet, all of that. It's like the beginning of the internet. And I was like really, you know, keen on learning more about all of that, like new technologies. So I landed my first job in a Danish startup. They were selling electronics online. It was a D2C shop. This was probably about 19 years ago. So there was nothing on Amazon, basically just books at the time. And then little by little, like, I've learned a lot, like different like categories, like D2C, what is, you know, what's a warehouse, like how does it work, how you move boxes from one place to another, literally how is it connected with this platform that counts your product. Also, it was like a very like basic level of everything 19 years ago. Also, you know, SEO, just like backlinks, you know, leaving comments on forums and like putting like backlinks and stuff like that. So it was like basically, it was like the beginning of modern e-commerce as we know it. And I was part of it, and I was really, really excited about the whole thing. So there was like 4 of us in the beginning, and then later on, the company grew to, I think, probably more than 300 people, and I was COO of the whole thing. Like, they were selling on 15 different marketplaces. They were starting selling on Amazon. So I got really, you know, interested in a bunch of different things. And then my former boss, he was not really interested in selling on Amazon. He was just there because he heard of the platform. He was like, let's do it. Let's just like, you know, let's just sell all best sellers over there, like 4 different marketplaces. And then, as I said, like, I had background in languages, and I was like, I think these like product descriptions are like really, really off. And at the time, like, you didn't have like any Helium 10s or anything, like, you know, keyword research. We did a lot of SEO for Google and ads, and that's like my bread and butter, actually. So I got the idea to hire someone from the call center that was like a native speaker to do just a translation for one of the products, just like a couple of bullets, and like that's it. And to do, like, to have the keywords from the AdWords, like to use the keyword trends and all of that, and just like to try to insert some of the keywords keywords, you know, just like iPhone mask or something like that, that made sense when it comes to the search volume. So I did a couple of products like that. And then in a month or so, we've started getting more impressions, and we've even sold a couple of things. And this is the first time I've heard about a buy box. You know, I was like, wow, like, let's try to win every buy box out there. And I started being more and more interested. And then I saw that a bunch of other products are like really not doing that well, especially in Germany or Spain. It was just terrible. I thought that this is an area where a lot of things can be improved and localized and just, you know, done much better job. And then I quit my job about 8 years after I was working at the company. And at that time, like, I was a really great e-commerce expert, really, in like, I could build everything from scratch. I could build a couple of shops. I was like consulting a lot. So I was like really, you know, trying to pour all the knowledge I've gained the last 8 years into helping others manage their businesses and improve what was, you know, what they were missing. And then I got the idea, like, why wouldn't I just start something on my own? I mean, I hadn't had any ideas of like being an entrepreneur before that. So I was not like, you know, 18 and like, if you asked me back then, like, hey, so what's your plan in life? I would have never told you, well, I want to build my business. I want to be a business owner and entrepreneur and all that. So that all that was not true. And then I first started thinking that I could do this when I was, I don't know, 32, 33. So fairly late when compared to what nowadays is possible. Like, now you have like millionaires like selling their SaaS tools when they're like 15 years old, right? So I was kind of like, I arrived like on the scene pretty late, but, you know, better late than never. And then I thought I should start something on my own. And, you know, like, I have like a bunch of contacts. I have all this knowledge. What am I good at? Like, you know, it's e-commerce and languages. I should put them all together. And then this is how Wild Tea Translations was born. And the first thing that we've done was with basically e-commerce translations. It was website. It was like for D2C brands. It was just other marketplaces. It was Amazon as well, but it was like all of the other things. And then little by little, like, people would come to our website and they would start asking about Amazon. And then I was like, okay, well, like, people ask a lot about Amazon, but I don't know if it's like worth, like, you know, telling them that we do only Amazon or like all these other things. They were really wondering, like, if we would do all of these things, are we like really experts in the field? Even though we had like a great team. And actually, it's funny you mentioned Apple, because some of my translators from the Dutch team, they used to work for Apple as a, you know, quality control in the translations and all of that. And they've been with us for a couple of years. And then I decided, you know what, like, I can train, you know, my whole team. I'm going to build this knowledge base, and we're going to have like an Amazon marketing translation experts. I think we're going to go niche, and I think this is going to be the right thing. So I just kind of really followed my guts. It was not about like, hey, maybe this, we'll try this. And I'm like, I'm just losing time. I'm just going to niche down and see what happens. Like, just do it. And I'm a really great overthinker. So I kind of really wanted to sabotage myself for such a long time. But I just like literally said, like, okay, we're going to migrate our old website to wildteatranslations.net, and then wildteatranslations.com, which had really like decent amount of traffic. We're going to transform it into an Amazon dedicated web page, which will say that we are experts in Amazon translations and this is what we are really good at. And that was a game changer. Honestly, the moment we niched down, what opened a whole new universe for us, because people were coming to us wondering, why do they only offer this one thing? They might be really good at what they do, which was absolutely true. But then also, like, it gave them the fact that, like, you know, if they're doing only this one thing, then, and if they're probably making money out of it, because why would they only do one thing? Because, you know, like, a lot of agencies, they would start with a niche that they'll understand that there's not too much money into this. Let's just add more services and this and that. I mean, this could be one of the reasons why agencies do that. I mean, there are probably other agencies that are just going to want to like go broader with that. We just never wanted to expand further than like the content thing. And then this is how we landed our first clients, because they thought that, you know, we really know what they're doing just because we're a niche business. So, you know, you hear all these people always say, you know, like, find your niche when it comes to product, when it comes to service, when it comes to absolutely everything. And that is the biggest truth out there, you know, like, to find your niche and not go too broad, because that will confuse people who you want to work with.
I guess that lesson obviously transcends across your own personal story with your business, right? But also the businesses that you're helping. If you're too broad and talking to, you know, a random customer that you don't know what they like or what they want, then you're not able to market to them. And I think that's one thing that you guys have, is that because you're Amazon focused, you're not just a translation service, which, you know, you can go and get a translation service, but they're not going to understand Amazon, how customers actually work, even down to the level of like, well, these keywords are actually important. That puts you in a position where you can actually help sellers really hone down on their market, because one, if they don't do that in their native language, they're going to struggle. But certainly if they don't do it in a foreign language for them, one, they're not going to understand that customer in depth, and two, they're not going to get the results they want, which may end up being, you know, that expansion to Germany or that expansion to Italy or wherever is a dud because they just didn't have it localized. I met you recently, a couple of weeks ago, in Milan, Helium 10 and Avask event, and you gave a story about a pasta maker, right? And I thought that was a really good way of explaining this, and I know all the Italians in the room were like, oh yeah. when you kind of gave the result. And again, it sounded like, and I thought, like, not irony, but intentionally, I guess you use that story because there might be maybe Italians in the room and you're talking about pasta. Right? I'm not sure if that was intentional, but I'd love you to tell that story for the listeners.
I actually love that example, and I have many others, but I was just like, no, we're in Italy and we are talking, I'm going to talk about pasta. And what is more Italian than, you know, Italians making pasta and having a pasta machine? So I decided to go for that example. And I mean, Italians, it was such a great audience, really. It was so easy to just like talk about it, you know. Like, the worst is like when you talk in front of an audience and then you have no feedback, no nothing, you know. And it's also, you know, I kind of also localized my talk to cater to Italians because we were in Milan. If I use that same example in Germany, because Germany, I feel like German audience is a tough cookie, you know, like it always is. It's like always very challenging for me to present in Germany because they're not really like great, not even like small talk, like they hate it, or just even like having any sort of like, you know, like funny comments, all of that, it doesn't really go well with Germans. Like, you have to be really like serious, like straight to business, it's black and white. So if I were to speak in front of a German audience, I would show them like this example, how we translated maybe something about, like, I for instance, for Germans, I usually use payment service provider we used to do translations for, and they were exhibiting at a big expo in Germany. So they had humble professional service, for instance. Like, we humble our customers. In German, like, we translated, nobody wants to see a humble service and think it's professional. So in German, you would say, professional service, we deliver what we promise, or something like that. We don't want to hear, like, customer care, humble service. Like, it's not something that Germans want to see. And definitely do not want to use that payment service provider because it doesn't align with their core values. So I would have probably used that example in Germany, and they would be like, oh, see, great point. I understand why localization matters versus Italian pasta in Bella Italia to Germans. Like, it would not sit that well. And also, like, you can joke a little bit more when you're like in Italy, and like, it's a little bit different. So I say that also my presentations, my talks when I'm on stage, like in the States, it's different. Like, I have to change things. I can't like present the same way in different countries where I talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, even down to things like, if I say, like, people come to me and for like the academy, because honestly, people say, hey, you sound English, right? We want to learn, we sell in the UK, we want to learn from someone that lives in the UK, just for those cultural differences and understanding a bit like how the British people work. We're maybe quite apprehensive, or we'll look at something and go, that doesn't seem quite right, always skeptical. It's a very different audience to that of the US audience, where it's all a bit more, I look at an advert in the US and go, that looks awful, that looks really spammy and horrible. But in the US, it's like totally normal. It's just totally normal to have that, and to have those billboards with like a lawyer on it. I'll tell you this story about Apple, because I think it's really interesting. This is quite a while ago now. I used to work for them. It wasn't my last job before I quit to do Amazon, but it was like probably my third last job. I was there for 5 years, and I used to be a trainer there. So I used to teach the team and all that sort of stuff. Well, a project came up where they said, hey, we need people to go to America, to Cupertino, to the headquarters for a project. Basically, put forward one person or two people from your country that can go. We didn't know what it was. We didn't know any of the details. They just said, put someone forward and then we'll send them. So they ended up sending me and I think one or two other people from the UK. And they did this from all of the different places where Apple have a like stores, essentially. We all turned up there. They literally said, you had to be at a car park at 8 a.m. on this Monday. And that's all the information we had. It was really, really super weird. And we got there and there's all these people, all different backgrounds from different countries, all like, what are we here for? What are we doing? And speculating like, why could we all possibly be here? What's be the possible reason? Someone came out, you're probably wondering why you're here. And we're like, yes. And they said, we can't tell you yet. So we all came in. What happened was, It was the iPhone and the Apple announcements they have in like September time. And what typically happens is that because Apple's so secretive, a very few amount of people actually know the full story. To get the training materials to the staff in the stores, they have to normally go through a translation service, basically. And they have to have these translated. Those people don't have access to that prior to the event, but the people in the stores need to know how to communicate things. And not all of them will speak English. They can't go onto the website and really translate these things. So they had us come in there and basically we're testing, could people locally, like if we bring people, do this faster or do it maybe more efficiently or cheaper? And we had to watch the announcement. We got given materials in American English. We had talks from like the marketing team and all sorts of stuff to say, look, this is what you need to do. If you have this, then this is how it needs to be presented because we're not going to check your work. We had to watch it and then we translate. So I was obviously going from American English to British English. Didn't take me that long. I'm gonna be honest. It wasn't that tricky. We were there for 2 weeks. Obviously, we were done within about a day or two for English. But the people, German, Japanese, Chinese, they took 2 weeks doing this. It was really, really hard for them because not only was it trying to localize for their native speaking, but also to get the text into the same frame because those languages are a lot longer, right? Or they might read a different way. And it was really, really challenging for them to do that. And I wanted to ask is, how do you find that? How do you make sure that, you know, your team have the right approach so that if they are going, you know, into Japan or something like that, the essence of the product is really communicated?
That is a really good question. So what we usually do is like we send out a onboarding questionnaire to the brand because I think we've worked with probably more than 4,000 brands in the last 6 years. And it's really hard to understand always what the brand's core value is or what is their brand voice and other things. So we decided to set out the questionnaire so we make sure that we're 100% on the same page. So we do keyword research. And then when it comes to keyword research, sometimes the brands would think that a certain keyword is very relevant for them. And we would think, well, this is probably too broad of a keyword, probably not going to put it in the title, for instance, but they insist on it out of certain reasons. So this like makes sure that we are on the same page. And also like if they want more formal or informal style, for instance, I'm going to post on LinkedIn how, for instance, like on Amazon Prime Black Friday week, Amazon's Black Friday week homepage, we've seen some of the categories where they mixed the formal and informal tone of voice on the same banner, which is something that, you know, Germans would really not like. Either stick to one or the other, not put both on the same cover. So we really make sure that we understand what the brand wants. Usually it's going to be probably informal. This is what everyone chooses. And it's a really good point you made about the length of the words in the language, because sometimes you have certain limits when it comes to different categories. Sometimes those bullets can go longer than 250 characters, for instance. And French language is the longest language, like the longest word. So a lot of times you have to do a little bit of the copywriting while localizing things, because not everything is going to fit in that character limit. So there are a lot of challenges that you have to when you do translations and localization, and you kind of have to fit them all in so they actually sound the same that they do in the source text. So you have to convey the same message that the brand wants you to convey using less words, different wordplay. Maybe there is not such idiom in Italian language that you're using in English. So there's a lot of things that you struggle with, and sometimes it gets really, really complicated. And that's why you can deliver, let's say, 10 ASINs in 2 days, because this is not a regular translation. Amazon content and optimizing it for different marketplaces is a really difficult process that involves localization, obeying all the rules, doing keyword research, embedding all of those keywords into your text, because without those keywords, nobody will be able to find your product. It doesn't really matter. Like you can have an amazingly written text, but without keywords, that product is probably not going to sell because it will never pop up for your potential buyers. So that is something which is really important. So localization is more than translations. And this is the most important thing that brands forget about. You want to localize your content and to present it to another audience. The audience that is buying your product on your home market is different than the audience that you want to offer this product to in a different country. Different customs, different everything. You know, going back to the pasta, like in Bella Italia, you know, just think of an example that you love back home. Let's say if you're a US brand, you love to go to Olive Garden, for instance. And then you mention like, you know, restaurants like Olive Garden. And then if you talk to a German, they haven't traveled to the States or they don't know a lot about US culture. They wouldn't understand what are you referring to saying Olive Garden. They'll probably think, oh, it's a restaurant. But Olive Garden has a certain tone to like what what type of restaurant they want. Olive Garden says, we're all family in Olive Garden, you know. But like in, for Germans, like they would not be able to grasp that tone and the same message. So this is what you always have to like, you know, ask yourself. Would someone that I don't know, like a random person on the street from London or from Berlin, would they know what I'm talking about if I tell them I love to go and eat in Olive Garden, especially on Saturdays because they have like this like cheese bread, you get them for free. Like they don't know any of that. So you really have to like put your mind to say like, okay, I have these unknown people. Would they be able to understand what I'm referring to? If this is the first time they saw me, my brand, and my product. This is what are the three very important things that you should keep in mind.
You mentioned idioms, right? And this is really interesting. This kind of triggered a weird memory. When I hired my first assistant, so this is, probably six years ago or something like that. In the job posting, so I went on onlinejobs.ph, and in the job posting, I was like, I really want someone that can grow with me and really understands like British culture as much as humanly possible. Because most of my clients are English. And I put some idioms, some English idioms. I thought if someone can reply, really understanding that, what I'm actually saying, they're the right person. I got a lot of responses from that, but the person that replied, they got it. They understood like what I was saying. I was trying to make a bit of humor with it. I hired them and they've been with me ever since. They're the backbone to all of our admin. They do absolutely everything and they get it. They really understand like English culture, which is really hard to find. And I think when we look at listings on Amazon, when you mention like the Bella Italia or the grandma's like pasta or non or whatever it is, nonna's pasta, that like picture or that those words really connect with you emotionally, and if you just use ChatGPT you're not gonna get that. So I think that's one of the really key things is how do you get those translations, but get those like magic moments, I'd probably call them, where people go, oh yeah, I get it.
I fully agree. I think you should sell that emotion. You should sell that moment in your childhood that you will, you know, remember, like how your nonna, your grandma used to make that hot pasta while it was snowing and all of that. You know, it's just like something that you, that evokes, that triggers that hormone in your brain that you're like, oh my God, I totally remember that. And you want to buy this product because it will make you bring those memories back to life. You know, I think that is the essence of like, you know, what the whole pasta and all the thing was with going with my example. But also it's like really important that you have like all of these like big brands, you know, saying Coca-Cola sells happiness, you know, and then I don't know, like Starbucks also, it makes you feel popular. You know, it just like it sells all of these things that you don't actually think about, because when you think of Coca-Cola, you're like, oh, it's a drink. I like to drink Coca-Cola. And they're like, no, we sell happiness. Like this is what, because you're like so happy when you drink Coke and when you think about it, you're like, oh, this is great. You know, like, or Nike, they sell like success or like, you know, able to outperform others, you know, like that feeling of power, you know, this is what they sell. And this is like all the, like those subliminal messages that actually got into your brain. And this is how they got it, by just trying to present it in a way. So they build this up inside of you. And then you actually get addicted and only want to buy things from the brand. I have a lot of people there exclusively want Nike products. There's like a bunch of like Adidas like accessories, like, you know, trainers, all of that. They're probably even like better looking at it, but they're like, no, I'm a fan of Nike till I die, literally. Like they don't want to even think about others. Like this is what like branding does to you. But you know, but they also like these big brands, they also localize their campaigns, they localize their products because they understand the power of that. You know, like there was a problem with Dolce & Gabbana, Italian designers, a couple of years ago when they launched their campaign in China. And so they, out of some unknown reason, they thought it was very cool to show a Chinese girl eating pizza with chopsticks. So this was a campaign on a big commercial in China. And China is one of their, probably the biggest marketplace for Dolce. So they decided to launch this commercial with just Chinese girl eating pizza with chopsticks. That made Chinese so furious with Dolce & Gabbana. They were disgusted by it because it was so culturally inappropriate to show this in China. It was so tone deaf that I don't understand what type of a PR team, like the damage control, like, had to be like issued after that. But they banned the Dolce & Gabbana merchandise from all of their e-commerce websites that year. So that cost them so much, and that hurt their image terribly. This is a true story. You can look it up. But it was just like, I think like now when someone looks at that commercial, you'll probably wonder like, who approved this? Like, who thought this would have been an amazing idea?
Have you seen the Jaguar? The Jaguar commercial?
Chinese culture with Italians. Oh, yes. I've seen Jaguar commercial. And I just think it's like wrong on so many levels. And honestly, you know, when you see that Jaguar, like the new logo, you think like the first thing I thought was like, if I hadn't known that it was like car brand, a car manufacturer, I would thought that they were selling either vapes or condoms or something like that along those lines. You know, I understand they want to move into like a more futuristic direction, like electric cars and all of that. But I think they literally, it was very disrespectful to their old customers, because when you talk of like who owns a Jag, you always thought of like these like older, very wealthy people. It had like a certain status with it, but a very graceful royal status, if you would like, if it comes with owning a Jaguar. So this new complete fully rebranding was like, I would not say this was a rebranding for Jaguar. I would call this like a completely new company, because this has nothing to do with the old Jag, like nothing. I mean, they completely destroyed it. I really, really didn't like it.
I do agree with you. To be honest, I'm not the best fan of like Jaguar Land Rover, just through personal experience anyway. But I always think about this experience. When you talk about these different companies have different feelings, I go to cars, right? I like cars and I think about this a lot. Mercedes, their tagline is the best or nothing. It's going for a certain type of customer. Or BMW is the ultimate driving experience. They're both German cars. They're basically the same. Same with Audi. They're like information technique, whatever the thing is, about technology in a car. But ultimately, if you strip them back, they all have the same technology. They all have very similar driving styles. The specifications very similar. All of them are nice, beautiful looking cars. But I'm a BMW driver, or I'm a Mercedes, or I'm an Audi. And people have that identity. And people have a Jaguar. I'm a Jaguar owner. Yeah. Not anymore, right? They're like, oh, maybe I don't want to be a Jaguar owner anymore, because it might be where things are going in the future. Maybe they're looking at the next 50 years thinking, well, how are we going to move to the next generation? Because ultimately, the older generation, they're not going to be here forever. And those customers that are buying, maybe they won't in the future. Potentially a bit premature in that decision. But I think that is, again, Budweiser did the same thing a year or two ago. They did that advert and it just was totally tone deaf for their audience, and they really suffered because of that. And sometimes you think, again, who makes these decisions? These companies, they go through so many different case studies and focus groups and different ideas and board meetings and all sorts of stuff, and then that's what they end up with. It's bizarre. When if they just got someone that really understood them from customer perspective, they'll be like, what are you doing? You guys are crazy.
I'm like really interested in like how they came to the idea, exactly how you said, like what was the roadmap of like what were they thinking? What was the mindset, like, you know, who, I mean, there's like a board directors, like all of that, like 15 people probably said yes to this kind of logo. That is what really puzzles me.
The people with those really large companies, they're not really running it, right? They are just kind of approving, they're disapproving, they're liking, they're not liking. If something has got to them, it's basically almost approved already, right? They're just giving the final sign off. And a lot of the times they're not really making those decisions. And I think that gives new brands, I don't know, look, people that we're talking to are not going to create their own cars. When you look at existing brands or legacy brands that are household names, a starter business can overthrow them. They can take market share from them by just speaking to the customer in a better way, because maybe they have lost touch with the customer. Like Gymshark might be an example of this. You know, they started, they got very famous. Everyone loved Gymshark, but then gradually over time, they lost their touch a little bit and they've tried to refocus back onto it, maybe more lately. And I'm not sure, maybe I'm in the algorithm of people that just don't like it. I'm seeing some people that love Gymshark 4 or 5 years ago, they're now like, it's just not the same anymore. It doesn't represent the values that we all came to it for.
See, this is exactly what I agree with, because I was a very big Gymshark fan. I even have a LinkedIn post about it and me, you know, exercising in the Gymshark. And I remember it cost a fortune. It was like an Instagram brand, right? And I was like, but you had to have it. I'm like, oh my God, I need to look this cool when I do my plank and all of that, you know? And that for me was all the hype. And like they were selling this like coolness and being like, yes, I have Gymshark. Are you a sharky too? I'm a sharky. You know, it was just like that. But then like, and then I remember when they opened their first store at Regent Street in London. And I remember I was going to London like on business, but I was just like, my priority is going to their, you know, store. Like I need to like make time to go to Gymshark store. So the first moment I went to the store, I was just like, it's a store and there's some gym clothes. They're not that great, actually. They're much better, like, you know, designs and all of that. It's just like another store. And I don't know, like my dreams about Gymshark were crushed at that time. Mm. When I went to the Regent Street store, it was packed. It was like thousands of people or like just like grabbing their, you know, pair of undies and shirts and all of that. But then to me, overhyped it so much. And it felt like getting in touch with every single person, every single influencer out there, like fat, slim, no matter what, we all want you to wear because we care about you. Like when they opened this store, I was just like, yeah, I don't have that feeling anymore. Mm. And then shortly after that, I agree what you said, you know, how they kind of lost the touch and lost what they were like, you know, building. And I understand that as you grow as a company, a lot of things get lost in the way. And then now I see they're trying to get back to the, you know, core of how they were, because I think this was what was selling their products. But I'm not sure if they're ever going to go back, whatever. But I mean, I'm not worried about them. I'm sure they're going to go public in a year or so. So I think it's going to be fine. But I was sad, you know, I felt like I was cheated on, you know, like I was just like, man, like I trust this brand. And then I didn't deliver what they promising. And then I literally took a day off from work just to go and visit this store because it mattered so much to me. And then I just didn't feel special at all, you know? Mm.
I think it's really hard for brands to do that as they grow, because you're right. It's a natural progression. As you get bigger, you might be super niche at the beginning, but as you get bigger, you're like, hey, look, we can try and target these different customers. We can see revenue coming from these types of people and let's market towards them. And I think it is really hard for brands, especially as they're growing, to say, let's try and continue to have our focus. I'm not sure if this is the same, but I learned a lot about branding, about customers, about the vision of companies through working at Apple. Because I had to train people, I had to really, really know this stuff inside out, because I was training the people that were customer facing. And if they weren't singing off the same hymn sheet, the whole thing breaks down. And that came down to a card, and it was called a Credo card. And it was just this big, an A5 or whatever, double-sided. And it just had, you know, our soul is our people, and we create enriching buying experience, or whatever it said. I can't remember it verbatim anymore. And that was the guide of, if we're doing a good job, if we're doing this, even if the decision that we're making in the moment is against like the company policy, does it align with this credo? In which case, we should do it. And I think that continued throughout my entire time working there, of saying, look, it says here that this is what we're trying to aspire within people, within customers. This policy says we can't do it. So which is right? Well, the policy's wrong, and this is right. So let's do this. And I think that's something that maybe this isn't the case anymore. I've not been there for quite a number of years now, probably 9 years or whatever it is. If you can maintain that within your brand, and you know who your people are, what you do, why you do it, and not just get stuck in the process and procedure and the operations of it, then I think that's where great things can happen. Like you were a COO for a period of time, and that is obviously making sure that the ship is running in the right place, in the right direction, aligned to the right vision. But I guess that can be really hard sometimes, to say no to some things when it doesn't align with where you want to go, even if you think it's a good idea. You think, hey, this is could be a really good idea, but it doesn't really align with our vision, so we have to kind of not do it. But I do believe that this leaves the door open for brand owners, for small to medium-sized businesses. They're trying to gain some market share from those bigger competitors. But I don't personally think it's a bad thing to go up against them. Like if I wanted to go up against Anchor, for example, they're a ginormous business on Amazon. They'd probably do 100 million a month, some ridiculous number. It doesn't mean that they're infallible. There are areas where they won't be serving their people correctly. And, you know, there'll be areas where you can insert a better branding message or speak to one of their customers better than they can. And I think that always leads to an opportunity. One thing I really wanted to ask you is, because I see people talk about this, and you mentioned AI at the very beginning of this. Why shouldn't we use things like ChatGPT or maybe online AI translation services? Because they are good, right? Maybe we can get away with it. Have you seen maybe the difference between you getting a translation through ChatGPT and then how you can really amend it and change it? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is a question I get this asked a lot. And I'm a very big fan of AI. And I think that, you know, if you... I mean, not you personally, but anyone who's not using AI and, you know, daily tasks, daily life, anything, like, what are you doing, right? So it's there to help us before they conquer the universe, right? But I mean, for this point today, it's like, you can do a lot of stupid tasks quicker and it can help you a lot. I talk to ChatGPT a lot. I'm like, hey, what do you think about this and that? And now he knows me probably than my, like, better than my husband and my best friend, but I find it really useful. But I don't think that it's going to be better than a human translator anytime soon. Not because they don't have the capacity, but I just think that they're not focused on building AI into the world's greatest translator. I think they're focusing on building AI for the other purposes, and they're always focusing on, you know, like, doing the coding better, launching rockets and stuff like that. Like, I think this is what everyone involved with AI is focusing on, and because they're focusing on that and not on translations, this is why it's not perfected to the point where we don't need any more human translators. Now, AI now has gotten much better and it's getting better by the day, but it still lacks it doesn't understand context and it doesn't understand nuances. I think it's great if you want to write about something from scratch, like you get it a prompt and say like, hey, I want to, like, you know, say something about this and that, and then it's great. But when it comes to translations, it a lot of times it doesn't even translate one part of the text, puzzles a little bit with what it's translated, tries to kind of, you know, make it, improve it, sound better. But then what it means for you as a brand owner is that if you give it like a content to be translated, let's say to put into your bullet, a lot of times it will not translate at all very important information because it will try to localize it if you prompt it that way, and then you would not know what it omitted because you don't speak the language, and then sometimes it will be very crucial information they're not going to be there translate to another language. That is one. So it doesn't always translate all the important information. And two is that is a regular translation, so it does make sense sometimes, but for some other categories it doesn't make any sense at all still. So it's like mixed feelings when it comes to like how good of a translation it is. I think it's great if you want to figure out how to use your vacuum cleaner, but I don't think it's great if you want to, you know, as we've been talking about, portray your brand and convey the same message in another language, and think that it will also evoke all those memories about you having pasta made by your grandma in Naples. Like, it won't do that. It will just, you know, translate the words as they are. And also I gave him a test with the pasta machine. The original text said it was a US brand, and they said pasta like in Bella Italia. When you present this to the Americans, they're like, oh, Bella Italia is like a native genuine, it's great, it's like homemade pasta, let's go there and eat. When you talk to Italian, it doesn't mean anything. Like, Bella Italia doesn't mean anything to Italians. And then I asked ChatGPT, you know, how would you localize and translate this sentence for me? So they would go saying like, pasta like in Bella Italia, like they would translate like in Italian. And then I asked ChatGPT, like, can you do better, because this is not what I'm looking for, it doesn't evoke anything, it's not localization. But I mean, look at this prompt, it's like huge, and it's like I'm getting into, you know, over explaining things how I want this to be done. And then ChatGPT came up with this sentence saying, pasta made in a traditional way, which is better than the first one, which is a literal translation. But pasta made in a traditional way versus our solution, which was like pasta like your grandma used to make, like your nonna used to make. I mean, it's like two different levels. Like, this is a little bit better translation, but the nonna sparks those emotions and it connects with your happy place in life, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what will sell your product, not pasta made in traditional way, because it's just text, right? This is text, and human translators are emotion. Mm. That's it.
I love that. And I do agree with you that, look, AI will get to a place where maybe it can do that sort of stuff. It's not better than it's not better than a human. Not. The same with graphic design. Like, I can have things made on AI using Midjourney or whatever. If I want a logo or if I want some packaging, I have it done by a designer, because they're going to be able to have a design eye. They know what looks good for a certain market, and AI just doesn't at the moment.
Very important thing is that if you want to do something from scratch and you want to, like, a text or a logo or packaging, you have to understand that AI is using all of the information that is already out there. So you're not going to get anything that has never, ever anyone seen before. It's not going to be like a 100 100% super creative image or something that is, you know, never been used before, because it always uses the information that are out there and available. While as humans, they will think of something that maybe nobody has ever used before, and it's going to be much more creative. So if you want like a text or design that is good enough or mediocre, this is what AI is going to give. Probably going to be better than what you would come up with, but it's not going to be stellar or fantastic, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's really important to leverage AI in your business. And one way that I use translations, and this is what I teach people about when they're cramming up with their brand name or a product name or whatever, is to go into GPT and say, this is our brand name. Does it mean anything negative or has any negative connotations, or is it a swear word or blah, 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 blah in any language? And just to say, yeah, it comes back and it has this connotation in Spanish, which means this blah, 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 blah. I think that's a nice little check that you can sometimes use, that you're not swearing or you're not saying like penis in another language, because you don't really want to have your brand name as that. That's something that maybe it can do. But if people want to...
Yeah, I have a really good example.
So it's a
Hyundai Kona. So Hyundai Kona was a well-known car model, except in Portugal, because Kona, it means the opposite of penis, just for female organ. So Hyundai Kona, the Kona, this is what it means. So they had to change like the whole like series. They had to like, you know, bring it back to the factory, so they changed it into Hyundai Kauai. Kauai is a Hawaiian island, but only in Portugal, because Kona does not mean whatever they want it to be. But I mean, just, you know, saying that such a big car brand, like you wouldn't think that these big amazing brands, they would let this happen, but they do. So, you know, Portuguese person driving Hyundai, and actually I was in Lisbon and I took a picture of this. Yeah. And I'm known for this example, and I'm like, oh my god, they missed one. They did not get it rebranded. That is
brilliant. And like, even like some car brands, they might be like an Italian car brand or whatever, and it's the something Stilo. It's just like the Fiat Pen or whatever, or the Seat Pen, and or the Seat Ibiza. It's just the party. And like, it sounds really cool and fancy in English, but actually it's just like a normal word in another language. But yeah, it's interesting how these big companies sometimes just don't check this stuff, which just seems absurd. Surely someone at the company goes, hey, we should probably check this. If people want to work with you guys, first of all, have a look at listings, they're expanding. You know, for me, a lot of the time I speak with UK sellers, they're expanding to Germany, they're expanding to the US, they're going to a different country, or they're coming to the UK. How can they reach out to you? What's the best platform? Is it go to your website? How do we get you?
Definitely go to our website, you can fill out the form, and we'll be happy to take a look at your listings. We do a full audit check, and then we let you know what's wrong, what's not wrong, what you can do better, or if you're just doing a great job, we'll say, you know, great job, and you know, keep up the good work. And also, if you want to get in touch with me, I'm very active on LinkedIn, so make sure to follow. I have a bunch of like really great updates when it comes to international expansion, some like really good case studies. Maybe some of the categories that I would analyze in a video is your product category, so you will be able to apply it to your business. So, you know, whatever I talk about, those are very actionable tips that you can apply to your business on your own. You don't have to hire anyone. And then, of course, if anyone else wants any other help with a brand, brand voice, all of that, I'm here to help as well.
Thanks again, Yana, for helping us survive Amazon. Now, if you are listening to this and you've found this episode useful and helpful, valuable, please do share it with other sellers, subscribe, comment if you're watching on a platform that allows you to do so that we can help other sellers continue to survive Amazon. Thank you all, and we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.